From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the second day of August 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Kurt Kimmel. He's the senior grains analyst at Bates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. And then later in this half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with the folks at the Andersons right here in Champaign County. In agricultural news, the World Bank has changed its tune on the impact of ethanol in the commodity markets. The Wind Energy Association is worried about future governmental support for turbines on the electrical grid. And New York City is moving towards a cleaner biofuels blend to heat homes and buildings. Details to come. We'll follow up those bioenergy stories in our second half hour today. During the farming world, we'll talk with Tom Bias of Growth Energy. He should join us live from his office in Washington, D.C. The energy legislation debate is in full swing, and we'll hear his view on how ethanol might play out and ask him about the food be fuel debate. Cattle numbers are down and look like they'll stay that way, and that K-State energy analysis we talked about last week suggests an E12 or E15 blend could quash exports. Tom Bias on the Farming World at 2:36 today. And online, of course, at willag.org as part of the Closing Market Report. He'll come up just after our Monday afternoon discussion of the ag weather with the folks at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago. The Closing Market Report is a production of the University of Illinois.
The Closing Market Report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to cooley at admworld.com.
In Chicago on this Monday afternoon, futures finished like this. The nearby September wheat is 6.93 1/4 settlement price, up 31 3/4. December at 7.23 1/2, 29 3/4 higher. And the July soft red winter wheat in Chicago finished at 7.10 1/4, $7, or rather, it finished up 28 3/4 on the day. The hard red winter wheat in Kansas City this afternoon, September at $7.50, up 26 cents. From the corn pit, September futures, 3.90 1/2, 2 1/2 lower, rather 2 1/4 lower. December at 4.04 1/2, down 2 1/4, and the March at 4.16 1/2, 2 1/4 lower. May corn at 4.24, down 1 1/2, and July at 4.30 1/2, down 1 1/2 cents. August soybeans at 10.53 1/4, 3/4 higher. September at 10.19 1/4, up 7 1/4. November at 10.10, 5 cents higher. August meal at 3.10.90, unchanged. August bean oil at $40.44, up 61 cents. On this Monday afternoon, this is the Closing Market Report. August feeder cattle futures finished at 112.60 today, down $1.12 1/2. Live cattle at 92.17 1/2. Down 47 1/2 cents, and the August lean hogs at $86.90, $1.07 1/2 higher on the afternoon. Outside markets, crude oil futures for the day. Settlement prices in the crude oil, if they come up, doesn't look like they're going to make that. We'll see if that happens in just a bit. Let's go on to the weather for the afternoon. It says mostly sunny skies. A high near 90, south winds at 6 miles an hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy here in Urbana-Champaign, a low around 71. South winds between 3 and 5 miles an hour. And Tuesday, a 30% chance of showers, some thunderstorms, mostly cloudy. A high near 93 tomorrow. Heat index values at 103. South-southwest winds between 5 and 10 miles per hour. That here in Urbana-Champaign. Tomorrow night, on Tuesday, a 30% chance of showers, some thunderstorms, partly cloudy, a low around 72. Winds out of the west between 3 and 6 miles an hour. And then Wednesday, again, a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms, partly cloudy. A high near 91, northwest winds at 7 miles an hour. Wednesday night, 30% chance of showers, low of 69. And Thursday, partly cloudy, a high near 90 degrees. Now, here are those settlement prices from the crude oil in the September contract, $81.44 a barrel, up $2.49. Ethanol at $1.72, that's 1 1/8 higher. Natural gas at $4.71 6/10, down 20 7/10 of a cent. And heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.15 7/10 of a cent, up 6 9/10 of a cent. Gold futures for the August contract, settlement price at $1,183.40 an ounce, up $1.70 in the Dow now, at 10,676, is up just about 210 points. The dollar at 80.94 is down 59.9.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Doug Slayton in Galesburg at 309-341-5003. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a Monday afternoon. Usually we talk with Kurt Kimmel at Debates Commodities in Normal, Illinois. He is not available. That's okay because Pete Manhart is with us this afternoon. Thanks for being with us, Pete.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about this marketplace. We rallied last week. We rallied in the month of July. And here we are on a Monday, the first trading day of August. Wheat futures sharply higher, and the corn can't manage to make a gain. What's up?
Well, we don't know if we've went far enough or yet, but I mean, technically we were overbought, but funds were buying, so it continued up. And I think the size of the crop, what's it going to be if it's above 164? We'll have a adequate supply. If it's under 162, we'll be very tight supply. And right here with this one, I think just couldn't hold it up there after the big move up of the month. And we were up 12 at one time today, so down 2.5 is not going to be a good on the technical end.
Not good on the technical end. Is it telling you and your clients that if they have old crop, they may as well finish it off?
They better be, you know, looking to get rid of them. And like today, I don't know what the basis is in places, but I had a guy where the basis was only 8 under or 16 under for different months, and he sold some of this year's crop also.
And you think that's a good idea, I take it?
I think for catch-up, if you haven't sold any yet, I think that's a good idea. If you've got, you know, a lot of your crop sold and or covered, I think you could still wait to see what the government report says next week.
Next week we do have a government report. That'll be important. It'll give us the first real look at what USDA thinks the size of the corn and the soybean crop in the United States might be, although those are really preliminary guesstimates. I suppose this year the crop is far enough along they might have a better shot at getting a good look
on
at it.
On corn, they should be able to count ears this year, but on beans it's still a stand count, not able to count pods. But they should be able to get fairly good ear counts on the corn.
And then the other fundamental things that are really happening, we have an energy bill that's stalled in Washington, D.C., not sure what will happen there, and there's the possibility of E12 and E15 out of U.S. EPA. And then we have this wheat supply problem that has been building out of Ukraine and Russia. What's news from there?
Well, it's Russia came out this morning and said they're still going to export 10 to 12 million metric tons, which is a lot more than industry had them after the drought became, you know, everybody became aware of it. So Russia's saying it's not that big of a problem. Other places are saying, yeah, it is.
Why is it that wheat futures managed to make such large gains today?
They're worried about that Russia not being able to export that many, and they would have to come to the U.S. And, in fact, Brazil and a couple other normal people that don't buy from us bought from us in the last week, bought corn and bought wheat.
And then maybe you can turn your attention a bit to the bean market, because this may be one that producers are thinking more about at this point, because the beans have stalled to some extent. They've got a crop in the field that they're not quite certain about, and then there's South America looming every 6 months after
yep.
We put a crop out of the field.
South America still has a lot of crop to ship from last year. They had a huge crop. China and Argentina were fighting over things, so that might be partly why China's continued to buy from us. But we do have possibilities if we grow 44 bushel average, which a lot of people think we can, that the carryout would go up to 600, which would be very bad on new crop soybean prices. So here above 10 bucks, we got to 10.29 today, closed at 10.10, still up 5, but should we be selling some here? I think we should be either protecting price or selling cash, depending on how much you have sold on out of your farm.
Yeah, when would you sell cash and then turn around and protect it, and how would you do that? If you're going to do it, and I'm going to make some assumptions here, that if you're at 35 or 40 or 50% sold and you sell more cash, that you want to protect the upside on it. Is that correct?
I would want to be at least 50 and maybe 60% cash sold. If I sell more than that, I'd probably want to take some protection by, you know, buying some calls or selling some out-of-the-money puts. Those things can both add possible to the price. But I really, if I'm 50, 60% sold, I don't know if I want to do anything right now, especially if I have crop insurance on the beans. Whereas corn, I do want to protect these prices here. Beaners, yeah, I want to get 50 to 60% either sold or protected, period.
Anything we ought to be watching on the livestock side of the ledger, please?
Livestock today, you know, made the big runs up, and today we were back off a little bit in the cattle. The feeder cattle were off quite a bit, but hogs managed to stay up there and hit 80 bucks today in the October. We still have good chances of the hogs now going up to the 83 mark. Cattle are kind of, we're worried about them with the high corn prices of them going very much further.
Yeah, despite that, the inventory of cattle remains tight and looks like it's going to be that way for a while.
Yeah, why would we have more? If the economies of the world improve, that ought to help cattle prices go up. If they don't, we could, you know, see them languish a little.
Anything else to add before I let you go?
Just to be ready to take advantage of bounces up.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That's Pete Manhart. He's with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. Happens each and every Friday afternoon, rather each and every Monday afternoon. If you'd like to hear Pete again, you can do that online at willag.org. That's willag.org. There you'll find all of our daily agricultural programming from the pre-opening market report to the closing market report, everything in between, including our weekend look at the marketplace. We call that Commodity Week. It's all posted not long after we produce the programming. And if you can't get to willag.org or hear us on the radio, you can always hear us on your phone. Dial this number at about 10:15 and 3:15 daily. We update either with the opening markets or the closing numbers and a bit of analysis at 217-333-3434. That's 217-333-3434. In today's agricultural news, new research from Bloomberg New Energy Finance reveals the governments of the world are spending substantially more on subsidizing what it calls dirty forms of energy than on renewable and biofuels. In all, BNFE says governments of the world provided about $43 to $46 billion to renewable energy and biofuels technology projects and companies in 2009. That figure stands in stark contrast to the $557 billion spent on subsidizing fossil fuels in 2008. That estimated by the IEA, or the International Energy Agency, last month. The Bloomberg analysis suggests the United States is the top country, as measured in dollars deployed, in providing direct subsidies for clean energy, with an estimated $18.2 billion spent last year. Approximately 40% of that went towards supporting the U.S. biofuel sector, with the rest going towards renewables. Speaking of renewables, the American Wind Energy Association is pressing for the inclusion of a renewable electricity standard in the energy legislation. The AWEA officials insist that a 15% mandate by 2021 has the 60 bipartisan votes necessary to clear the Senate. American Wind Energy Association CEO Denise Bodie says a national mandate for renewable energy is crucial. Bodie says her group will make every effort to get it done. She says it's about the survival of the industry. The American Wind Energy Association reports that wind energy installments dropped 71% during the second quarter of 2010 compared to the same period last year, and 57% compared to the second quarter of 2008. Bodie attributes the drop-off to the lack of a federal policy requiring utilities to add wind and other renewable energy sources to their portfolios. Well, the World Bank has changed its tune on biofuels and the impact it's had on commodity prices. The Development Prospectus Group at the World Bank has concluded the effect of biofuels on food prices has not been as large as originally thought, but the use of commodities by financial investors may have been partly responsible for the 07 and 08 spike. Authors of the report say energy prices were important in the non-energy commodity price spikes seen in the past, and concluded that it's unlikely biofuels played a big part because they just didn't represent a large enough percentage of the worldwide grain and oilseed trade. And finally today, starting in October of this year, all heating oil sold in New York City will contain a blend of 2% biodiesel. Legislation providing for the sale of BioHeat, a blend of heating oil and biodiesel, was passed last week. Shelby Neal, state regulatory director for the National Biodiesel Board, points out that New York City is already the largest municipal user of biodiesel in transportation applications. Neal calls this latest move a progressive step towards cleaner emissions from heating the homes and the buildings there. New York City uses more than 1 billion gallons of heating oil a year, so 2% biodiesel represents a 20-million-gallon market for the commodity. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Monday afternoon. Stay with us if you can for the second half hour of our program today. We'll talk with Tom Bias of Growth Energy. If you can't, you can always hear it online at willag.org. Now, up next, you know, there had been some long-drawn conclusions that one of the benefits of climate change might be higher crop yields. It seems a small consolation, and one, as you'll hear, that is not panning out when taken from theory to reality. Lab experiments prove plants do better when more CO2 is around. That's carbon dioxide. And while most haven't taken much solace from that laboratory fact, it has given the world some hope as it relates to climate change and crop production. Climate change is coming along with higher CO2 levels, which, by the lab theory, should stimulate yields. There's a problem with the theory. It does not seem to translate into higher crop yields in field experiments. University of Illinois Professor of Crop Sciences Steve Long has been field testing the lab results for several years in an experiment called Soy Face.
Well, now that we have experiments where we can actually elevate the carbon dioxide level in a very controlled way in a farmer's field, we're not seeing those stimulations in the field. And that is of concern because that stimulation is one of the factors which is expected to offset the more damaging aspects of climate change in considering global food production.
The experiment Long operates at the University of Illinois is called Soy Face, or soybean-free air concentration enrichment. He grows crops outdoors in the field, but alters the atmosphere for higher levels of carbon dioxide and ozone, higher temperature, and controls the water supply. Soyface was designed to discover the effects of atmospheric change on the agronomy and productivity of Midwestern crops, as well as to find solutions that will lead to crops better adapted to the climate of the future. What Long has found, again, is that the projected crop yield increases, supposed to come with higher CO2 levels, just are not there.
I wouldn't say it's not true at all, but we're only seeing, in these large field-scale experiments, we're only seeing with soybean and wheat and rice, we're only seeing about half of the response that was expected and half the response that has been used in predictions of future food supply.
It's not the silver lining in climate change that scientists, like Illinois Professor Long, had expected.
It's certainly not the silver lining we were expecting. On the other hand, if we can show that plants can do this in the laboratory, then we really need to understand, well, why isn't this happening in the field? Are there factors we could be selecting for genetically that would overcome this so that we would get the theoretical gain? What we have found here with our work on soybean is that there is variability between cultivars. So it appears there must be some genes which do favor this response.
That is to say, there are some varieties of soybeans that thrive in CO2-rich environments. The good news is that the Soyface experiment is helping to determine which genetic variabilities in the plant are most likely to result in a better-yielding soybean for the future. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Monday afternoon. Time to check the agricultural cash grain markets. On the phone line with us from the Andersons right here in Champaign County is Greg Johnson. Good afternoon to you, Greg.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Are farmers interested in making sales today?
Yes, yes. We were very busy today. Lots of corn being sold. Finally started seeing new crop sales made. Up until late last week, it was almost all old crop corn, but new crop corn sales started being made, and even a few new crop bean sales today. So that's a good thing to see, I think.
We usually get your bids at the end, but we probably ought to know what they are up front so we know where we're at today.
That would be a good question. Let's see here. I don't have my bid sheet.
Well, you take your here. Time.
Oh,
have
I,
some.
How about now? I've got one here. How about 378 for old crop corn, 374 for new crop corn, 396 for January corn. Then old crop beans are 1050, new crop beans are 982, and January is 991.
Okay, when you're making the new crop sales, are they doing January delivery for the most part then, or are they selling it over the scale?
Most of them are still over the scale. I think and I agree, we'll probably see even higher prices yet by next January, February, with all the wheat rally the last month. And I think we will see more wheat acres planted this year, especially with the corn and bean harvest probably going to happen earlier, certainly earlier than last year, and that should allow farmers plenty of time to plant wheat this fall if they want to. And with these kind of prices, I would think some will, much more wheat will get planted. So that means less acres available for corn, and so I think we'll have that acreage battle again. And so I think we will see higher prices for corn in, that January, February time frame. But you have to have storage to be able to take advantage of that. So for people that don't have storage, these are good prices to get some corn sold for the fall bushels. But storage bushels, I think, farmers can afford to wait and be a little patient on those.
Storage was one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because you probably have some old crop corn that's not in the best of condition and you're hopeful to blend it off. Does it create a storage problem for you this fall at all?
It takes up space. I mean, it takes away space that would be available otherwise, but probably the bigger thing for us is going to be the soybean space. Processor over in Danville that normally took beans, anywhere from 10 to 12 million bushels of beans per year, isn't crushing beans anymore. So those 10 to 12 million bushels have to find another home. And while some of those will go to some other processors in the fall, that's a nightmare to sit in line. So they can't all go there. So, everybody's going to get a share of those beans, I think, and that's going to take away some space that that we were planning to have available for corn. So it's going to get a little tight if the crop is there, and another rain or two, and I would like to think that maybe the crop is there.
How are you handling that internally as you talk about storage, and then what are you telling the client base?
Well, we're saying the bean basis has improved tremendously. We were 40, 50 under for the first 6 months of the year, and then it improved into 20 under, and I think we're currently at 27 or 28 under. So that's a definite improvement, and we always tell them to reward the market when the market rallies. It's the same way with the basis. You want to reward the market when the basis rallies. So it looks like space is going to be tight, and it looks like the basis has improved, so why not take advantage of that and lock in your bean basis and maybe even the corn basis to the same extent. It hasn't improved. We've been at 30 under since the first of the year, but we're only a month away from harvest or so, and as things get closer to harvest, the basis tends to widen out a little bit. And then get better, as we get through the first two-thirds of the harvest.
All right, Greg, thanks much.
Thank you, Todd.
Mm-hmm. Greg Johnson is with the Andersons, joins us from their office right here in Champaign County on a Monday afternoon. In just 2 minutes, I'll return when we'll talk about the agricultural weather forecast.
It's National Ice Cream Sandwich Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1791, Samuel Briggs and his son, Samuel Briggs Jr., became the first father-son pair to receive a joint U.S. patent. Their invention was a nail-making machine. In 1861, the first U.S. national income tax was passed to aid the Union war effort. In 1880, the British Parliament adopted Greenwich Mean Time. GMT was originally set up to aid naval navigation, but it was not used on land until transportation improved. By the way, GMT was adopted by the U.S. on noon on November 18th of 1883, when telegraph lines transmitted time signals to all major cities. Before that, there were over 300 local times in the U.S. In 1887, Rowell Hodge received a patent for barbed wire. In 1956, the first new contract to build a section of the U.S. interstate highway system was awarded. It was for a portion of Route 66 in Missouri, which eventually became Interstate Highway 44. By the way, the Highway Aid Act of 1956 established a 90% federal funding level for national limited access highways. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
It's a Monday afternoon. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Time to check the agricultural weather forecast. The folks at Chesapeake Energy in Chicago on the 23rd floor of the Boeing building are with us. Josh Starr on the phone line. Good afternoon to you, Josh.
Good afternoon, Todd. How are you?
Oh, I'm very good. How's the view for today?
Hazy. A little hazy. Thunderstorms have been over Iowa earlier today, and the Sierra is starting to blow over the state of Illinois. Not a lot of shower activity yet in Illinois, but that will be more so in tomorrow. As lines of thunderstorms pop up across the northern half of the state. And then again, actually, on Wednesday night into Thursday morning, we have another round of thunderstorms before drier conditions and a better northwest flow comes in late this week and the weekend. And so we remain relatively comfortable this week with continued active conditions. And for the northern half of the state, actually, there are some areas that have been building some pretty decent 30-day precipitation deficits with some areas in far east central Illinois running less than 50% of normal precip, and certainly this pattern upcoming this week for soybeans in particular would be very favorable to just-in-time rains to make sure they fill out through pod development.
That's good in Illinois. Did you say Iowa was getting some rainfall this afternoon?
Yes, thunderstorms have been firing up across Iowa, more so earlier today. They're starting to die out here this afternoon, but they also will see thunderstorms, well, they'll see thunderstorms on Wednesday afternoon before it comes through Illinois Wednesday night, Thursday. So it just continues this active bias across the central northern portions of the Midwest, which we've seen much this summer.
It takes care of Iowa, Nebraska, Illinois, probably Minnesota, I suppose. They'll get some rainfall all this week. Then we might want to be concerned, I suppose, about the southern part of Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. They've been drier. Will they see rainfall?
It looks like reduced rainfall across the southern belt. The ridge of high pressure, which has been just a very impressive feature this summer, continues to result in a drier than normal bias across southern Illinois, far southern parts of the Midwest, and even today temperatures are only in the upper 80s to low 90s, but that is one of the cooler days they will see here over the next 10. You go further south into the northern delta acreage, and there's some temperatures of 100 with a dew point of 80, heat indices up near 120 today, and this ridge down south has just been incredibly impressive.
Then turn your attention to the place that's been getting a lot of attention in the marketplace, that's Ukraine and Russia. The wheat crop there, the harvest starts about this time and runs through the month of August. Are they still dry?
To say they're dry is an understatement, Todd. They're undergoing one of the worst droughts in the past 130 years, and that's as far back as data goes from a precipitation standpoint across Russia. You can compare this to some of the most memorable droughts, like the 1972 drought in Russia.
All right. Anything else to add before I let you go for the afternoon?
That's the major highlight globally.
Okay. Thanks much.
Thanks, Todd.
Josh Darb is with Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. Happens each and every Monday afternoon. You can always hear it again if you'd like at our website. The address is willag.org. Download us as a podcast automatically to your computer. Listen to it off the website
or just call this phone number, 217-333-3434, and listen to us on your voicemail. It's all right there, and it's all available for you anytime you'd like. Stay with us if you can for the Farming World. It comes up next.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This is the Farming World News and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign, the University of Illinois. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're going to talk about the Agricultural Energy Bill, a bit about ethanol with Tom Bias. He's the CEO and president of Growth Energy in Washington, D.C. He joins us from his office this afternoon. Mr. Bias, thank you for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
First, we better talk a bit about Growth Energy, what it is and how you became to be involved in this organization.
Well, Growth Energy, Todd, was formed in the fall of 2008 by a group of ethanol producers who basically wanted to counter all that misinformation that our critics was putting out there, everything from food versus fuel and environmental criticisms, as well as indirect land use change and those items. And we now consist of 61 ethanol-producing plants across the country with 17,000 what we call growth force supporters, and that's people that actually believe that ethanol is a good thing and want to get out and help pass the message, farmers, consumers, et cetera. We have been actively engaged in a lot of the debates that have been relevant to the industry since then, almost all of them, including we filed the Green Jobs Waiver, which with the Environmental Protection Agency, which allows EPA to raise the blend wall from 10% up to 15% for all vehicles and all gasoline engines. We also got very involved in the indirect land use debate in Congress and got some changes enacted on the House side. Unfortunately, we've not had much luck because the Senate seems to be stymied, it would be the word of the day, and moving forward on any type of legislation, but we're still trying there as well. And more recently, we've been trying to engage in the debate on energy and where we need to go as an industry. What's our biggest barriers? What are our strengths? And obviously, our biggest barrier is not producing ethanol, but finding an open market in which to provide more of the product. We like to tell folks ethanol is today's fuel. It's America's fuel. It's produced right here in America with American jobs, grown, the feedstock's grown on American farms, and the benefits go into American consumers.
Let's take up the food v. fuel debate just first off, and then we'll get to the legislation that you say is stymied in Washington, D.C. On the food v. fuel debate, some press releases last week from the World Bank, they were taking a look at the impact of ethanol, I suppose, on the run-up in commodity prices in 07 and 08. And they backtracked at this point on the reasons that they think commodity prices had gone up. They had suggested early on in some of their white papers that ethanol was responsible. Apparently, that's not the case anymore.
No, and it's about time they backtracked. It's, I mean, almost any economist who looks at this issue will conclude the same thing. And we've been saying that for quite some time. Our critics that have their own vested interest in not seeing this nation move to ethanol, whether it's the status quo and they want continue to rely on imported oil or they want cheap commodities or whatever the reason, did a pretty good trash job on the industry by saying that all those food price increases were a result of ethanol. And we all knew that wasn't supported by facts. It wasn't even close. Yet they had a very well-organized, well-funded campaign, and that kind of stuck. And the World Bank even had a report a couple of years ago, and people widely quoted this report as saying that ethanol was the reason that food prices spiked. And we all know, we knew then, they finally realized today that that wasn't the case. The real culprits were energy, ironically, all the costs to transport food around the country and the world, unregulated speculation in the commodity markets. When Wall Street couldn't make money on Wall Street, they stuck it into commodity markets as a hedge against inflation and to make money. And then the third factor was the weak dollar, which drove up exports to record levels. And any time you have a weak dollar, that makes your products more competitive overseas, and that's exactly what happened. Ethanol, unfortunately, got blamed for it, and we think there's a lot of groups out there that still owe us an apology and a retraction.
All right. So let's move on to today's marketplace. I sent, and I think you probably had just a bit of a look at it, a piece by Dan O'Brien at K-State. We talked to him last week on Tuesday during our regular Ag Energy segment about a piece that they had produced, looked at the impact that E12 and E15 might have on the marketplace if things were to stay static in the marketplace, and they never do. But if they were to stay static, their answer was that if there wasn't a contraction in the livestock supply in the United States, that the export market would be the place where things might go down dramatically. For those who live in Illinois, along the Illinois River, along the Mississippi River, this would be of great concern. Did you take a quick look at it, and what did you think of his work?
Well, I just saw it very briefly, and again, I think you hit the nail on the head. These things don't remain static. If prices start to move up because of a greater demand in the marketplace for whatever reason, American farmers respond. They are the most productive sector in our nation's economy since day one, if not the world. And if you, and I think this was demonstrated a few years ago when prices started to go up, producers respond. And they respond not just in expanding acreage, but in increasing productivity. And that's where a lot of these reports and studies miss the point. We're not going to continue to grow the same amount of corn per bushel or overall volume on the same acres every year. It's going to continue to go up. It has in the history. All the people involved in the newest seed technologies are anticipating it going up even faster. I mean, that line of yield productivity is almost vertical. It's not horizontal. It's almost vertical. So give a price to a farmer, and they've proven over and over again, they won't just produce, they'll overproduce. I mean, that's usually one of the problems that we face.
So you're confident that supply would be able to meet all of those demands?
Well, sure. It hadn't been that many years ago that we were talking about a 10 billion bushel corn crop being unheard of. And today, it's pretty much the norm that we have a 13 billion bushel corn crop. And last year, we had the all-time record corn crop on 7 million fewer acres than the previous record. I think that's a concern that shouldn't be a concern. Because that productivity capacity is tremendous in American agriculture. They're the best industry ever at producing.
Let's turn your attention to what's been happening in Washington, D.C. The energy legislation, comprehensive energy legislation, that had been slated to take the front line in Washington at some point simply dissipated. It included some cap-and-trade things. Are those gone now for good for a while?
Oh, I think the cap-and-trade stuff's been on the back burner and not going anywhere for quite some time, probably a year or so. But I do think that the Senate needs to address energy legislation. You know, it's just been 2 years ago that we had all-time record gasoline prices, which had a devastating effect on our nation's economy. And we all know it's coming again. You look back over the last 40 years and all the economic shocks and wake-up calls we've had as a nation because of our addiction to foreign oil. Well, we can't just keep getting hot and cold over this issue. We got to keep moving forward. And biofuels, and ethanol in particular, is an existing alternative to foreign oil today. But we face barriers on how much we can produce. We don't have a problem producing it. We have a problem of getting to the marketplace, and that's what we think is front and center that should be in this debate, because a lot of these other energy sources may or may not pan out 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, 30 years. We're here now. And just going from E10, Todd, to E15 is the equivalent of reducing our dependence on foreign oil by 7 billion gallons annually. That's 7 billion gallons that we're not paying someone else's into someone else's economy, creating jobs in their economy, but keeping it right home, right here, home in America.
Majority Leader Harry Reid was hoping to put some legislation forth this week. You say that's stymied. What is happening on the Hill?
Well, Senator Reid has indicated that he's going to try to move his legislation this week, although there are a lot of people that seem to think that it won't get enough bipartisan support to move forward. We certainly want to see that legislation amended to include opportunities for ethanol if it starts to move forward, and that's what we're preparing for. We hope that debate occurs. We hope they get something moving to actually reduce our dependence on foreign oil, but no guarantees. You know, it's an election year, and you often get into this climate where one side says it's sunny, the other side will say it's dark, and vice versa. I, for one, hope that leadership prevails and people roll up their shirt sleeves like you would in rural America and work out these differences and move forward.
Is this the Clean Energy Jobs and Oil Company Accountability Act? Is that right?
Yes, it is. And Senator Reid just scaled back that to a minimal bill that doesn't do a lot. But I would note he does have a provision in there to provide infrastructure changes for converting diesel engines to natural gas, but nothing similar for the infrastructure challenges for biofuels. And something we're pushing really hard is mandatory flex fuel vehicles of all cars sold in America and blender pumps nationwide, and that puts the power in the hands of the consumer and allows us to compete in an open marketplace without the barriers of a blend wall, et cetera, into the future. So we want to get to the point where we can make our case. We're not sure it's going to happen, but we're going to be prepared when it does.
And we have just a couple of minutes before we need to take a break. What is it that your members are doing on Capitol Hill at this point to try to convince legislators on both sides of the aisle that they ought to support this bill and an amendment to it?
We are certainly contacting them. We work them all the time. We're getting phone calls into them that if they're going to move forward on energy, don't leave the obvious alternative today to foreign oil on the sidelines.
And how quickly does this need to be done? Because they'll be going on recess at the end of the week, right?
Well, they go on recess for a month, and then they'll come back in September and be in for just probably about another month, and then they'll recess for the election, and then most likely have to come back after the election in a what they call a lame duck session and complete their work. And whether it occurs this week or next month or the following the election, we think it needs to occur.
And what's the likelihood it'll happen this week?
I learned a long time ago, Todd, not to make predictions for those folks over there under the Capitol Dome, because if you do, you're probably going to eat your words. But most people seem to think the chances are not very good.
You're listening to The Farming World this afternoon. Our guest is Tom Baez from Growth Energy out of Washington, D.C. We're talking about energy legislation and ethanol. When we return, we'll continue our conversation back in just 2 minutes.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's National Ice Cream Sandwich Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1791, Samuel Briggs and his son, Samuel Briggs Jr., became the first father-son pair to receive a joint U.S. patent. Their invention was a mail-making machine. In 1861, the first U.S. national income tax was passed to aid the Union war effort. In 1880, The British Parliament adopted Greenwich Mean Time. GMT was originally set up to aid naval navigation, but it was not used on land until transportation improved. By the way, GMT was adopted by the U.S. on noon on November 18th of 1883, when telegraph lines transmitted time signals to all major cities. Before that, there were over 300 local times in the U.S. In 1887, Rowell Hodge received a patent for barbed wire. In 1956, the first new contract to build a section of the U.S. interstate highway system was awarded. It was for a portion of Route 66 in Missouri, which eventually became Interstate Highway 44. By the way, the Highway Aid Act of 1956 established a 90% federal funding level for national limited access highways. And that's this day in agricultural history.
You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Our guest this afternoon on The Farming World is Tom Bias of Growth Energy out of Washington, D.C. We're talking about energy legislation and ethanol. Mr. Bias, thank you for staying with us this afternoon. Can we take up the amendment that is being put forth by Senators Lugar and Harkin to Senator Harry Reid's energy legislation? That would be the Clean Energy Jobs and Oil Company Accountability Act.
Sure.
And it does three things that you're hopeful will help with the production of ethanol and its adoption across the United States?
Yeah, what I think they're prepared to offer as an amendment if Senator Reid's legislation is allowed to proceed. I mean, the first thing they'll have to do is invoke cloture, which means shut off the possibility of a filibuster. And then we're hoping to get that legislation amended if they get the cloture vote and are able to go to that process. And the Harkin-Lugar amendment basically is very similar to legislation they've introduced before called the Consumer Choice Act. And what it does is it mandates a timetable for automakers that sell cars in the United States to convert those to flex fuel vehicle. Or to manufacture flex fuel vehicles for sale, and that's something that's really, really needed. It costs less than $100 at the time of manufacture to produce a flex fuel vehicle, but it gives the consumer all kinds of options on what type of fuel they can use. And the second component is to get blender pumps installed nationwide, and blender pumps are basically a pump that will allow the consumer to pick up to five different blend levels. So if the economics say put in E85, they can pick E85. If it's E50, it's E50, et cetera. And combined with a flex fuel vehicle, you don't have to worry about what kind of, how much ethanol you put into your auto. So that those two are really critical. The third component is just establishing a federal loan guarantee for anyone who wants to put together an ethanol pipeline. That money has to be repaid, and it has to be based on sound business practices. It's not a grant. It's basically a loan guarantee, similar to what the federal government does now for natural gas pipelines.
As I read, speaking of natural gas, as I read the text of the Clean Energy Jobs and Oil Company Accountability Act. That's the energy bill that's being introduced or could be introduced by Senator Reid. The Harkin-Lugar amendment looks like it runs fairly parallel with many of the things that Senator Reid would like to have happen for natural gas. I'll make point that it's also for LNG or liquefied natural gas, which we would know as propane, so that there would be a way to convert vehicles. You might be able to get paid for that. There would be infrastructure built into that. And that the Harkin-Lugar Amendment looks very similar to that. Do you think the two pair well together?
I think they do. And you know, I think anyone who's upfront and honest with you on the energy debate and how our nation becomes energy independent certainly understands it's going to take a variety of different types of fuels and a variety of renewable fuels for us to really make a dent and become energy independent. But we know we can do it. You know, again, you have to have a plan. And you look at what Brazil has done, and they did this beginning in the 70s. Well, we kind of went back to sleep after the first oil embargo and prices went down and supplies came up. They kept their nose to the grindstone and they built out their infrastructure. And today, you know, Brazil is almost energy independent, if not completely so. So we can do the same. You just have to have a plan. You got to stick to it. And you got to do the art of the possible, not what may happen in the future, but what you can do.
Last week, your organization, Growth Energy, which primarily has, as you told us up front, folks that are producing ethanol as membership, asked producers to make phone calls to their senators in support of this amendment. Have you been able to judge whether producers have reacted or not?
Well, I think they are, and I think once that debate starts to occur this week, they'll weigh in even more heavily, because I think they understand what really needs to happen. And, you know, if we get a build-out marketplace with the infrastructure barriers removed, as this legislation seeks to do, we know we can compete. Again, we don't have a problem producing ethanol. We have a problem with market access, and that's because of artificial barriers that have been erected over time, and we just need to remove them and move forward.
We have 50 seconds. I know you want them to call and have their legislators support the Harkin-Lugar Amendment to the energy bill. Do they also need to ask their congressman and senator to push forward the Clean Energy Jobs and Oil Company Accountability Act?
Well, I think the main thing is to watch and see if the legislation moves forward, is to weigh in and support on the amendment.
Okay.
You know, we don't necessarily take a position on the other stuff that doesn't relate to us. We try to make it ethanol specific, and we will certainly get that message out as the next couple days unfold. We'll know a lot more.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd.
Tom Bias is with Growth Energy out of Washington, D.C. Join us here this afternoon on The Farming World. If you'd like to hear it again, you can always do that off our website. Look for it in the Closing Market Report at willag.org. Our thanks to Mr. Bias and Growth Energy for joining us live this afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason.